You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Overshadowed by President Trump's impeachment trial, the administration recently added six more countries to the travel ban. We'll look at why they were added and reactions to that move coming up. Now, the movie Crazy Rich Asians was a big box office hit in the U.S., earning its top spot in the top 10 highest grossing romantic comedies of all time, according to Box Office Mojo. That's led some people to say we're seeing a rebirth of the rom-com genre. But our next guest says it actually never died completely. It's just been subtly changing over the years. Catherine Morrissey is an assistant professor in the School of Cinema at San Francisco State University. She's the author of a three-part series for Flow Journal titled From Crazy Rich Asians to Netflix, the, quote, rebirth of romantic comedies. Catherine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, once upon a time in my youth, certainly, romantic comedies, they were often box office gold, right? Could you take us back to that, what was it, 80s, 90s heyday of the romantic comedy?
Yeah, we saw a big, big surge in those films in the 80s and 90s after a kind of quieter period. And they were really financially successful for Hollywood because they, well, depending on who was starring in them, they could cost, you know, not that much to make, but they tended to get a lot of popularity and a lot of ticket sales. So they were seen as a really good product within Hollywood.
And they seem to slip away, though. What happened? Why didn't they hold up that box office domination?
Well, it's, you know, it's hard to know if there's any, you know, one reason. In general, movie ticket sales have been declining. You know, less people go to the movies. There's a lot of other kinds of entertainment people can pursue. But, you know, more broadly, there have been less romantic comedies made in the last 10, 15 years. And part of that is because, you know, the movie industry is putting a lot of money and time and investment in these really big budget global media franchises, and they don't have as much to spend on these kind of medium budget romantic comedy films.
Let's listen to a bit of one of those classic romantic comedies. This is 98. Is it that late? You've Got Mail. This is a scene with Tom Hanks and Dave Chappelle, who was in that. Who remembers?
So I suppose she's carrying a copy of a book with a flower in it?
Not really.
Oh, she could be a real dog, man.
I'm only staying 10 minutes. I'm going to say hello, I'm going to have a cup of coffee, and then I'm going to split. That's what I'm going to do. I hope she doesn't have one of those high, squeaky voices like the mice in Cinderella. I hate that. Why am I even doing this? Why am I compelled to even meet her? Why?
Why indeed? it was always that formula, like, there's no way this is going to work out and become a romantic relationship, but then it does. Was there a pretty solid formula back in those days?
Yeah, I mean, there always has been with romantic comedy films. The genre's been around since, you know, the beginning of cinema, and they tend to talk about it as kind of a meet-lose-get narrative pattern. You know, the two people meet, things seem to be going well, then suddenly things are not going well, and then eventually they get back together.
No way.
Yeah. And, you know, in some ways, that pattern might be part of the problem, right? In the sense that right now, if we think about what romance and love looks like to individual people, it means very different things. And society's gotten a lot of, you know, society's changed a bit in terms of what they think and what they expect from couples. And so I think some of that is just, it's hard for movies to know what's going to stick with audiences when that older formula seems a little outdated at times.
Talking to Catherine Morrissey from San Francisco State University, looking at the fall of the big box office romantic comedy, but not the disappearance. And that's a big part of your piece, Catherine. You say romantic comedies, yeah, they weren't the dominant big box office movies, but they never really went away. How have they transformed over the years?
Yeah, so something interesting happened in the 90s when we started to see the indie film industry kind of build up a bit. A lot of these very romantic and very funny films were still being made alongside the kind of traditional blockbusters like You've Got Mail, but suddenly, you know, they might be starring two men falling in love, or they might be talking about two women. We also saw in the early 2000s and into the 2010s a lot of films with large ensembles of African-American actors, you know, telling multiple love stories. And these films didn't necessarily get the kind of media attention and box office numbers that something like You've Got Mail did, but they were certainly perfectly solid, successful films that did well within their own kind of markets. You know, if it's an independent film, it's not going to sell as many tickets necessarily as Crazy Rich Asians. But they were critically acclaimed and well received.
But in your piece, you write they weren't always classified under the romantic comedy label. They were, you know, African American films, say.
Yeah, exactly. And you see that happen a lot, right? Because the romantic comedy label isn't just about the story being told. It's also about how the film is marketed in the industry. And if rom-com is an idea that is kind of packaged typically with straight white people who are relatively well off financially, then, well, you know, these other films start to be, you know, maybe marketed as something else. Maybe they're marketed as queer cinema or as independent films or as urban comedy, you know, something like that. So you see them circulate in different ways. You know, something like 40-Year-Old Virgin, for example, you know, in many ways that's a romantic film. It's a funny film. It's a romantic comedy, but that's not necessarily what it was sold as.
I want to give a listen. You just mentioned Crazy Rich Asians from 2018, a scene here with Constance Wu and Henry Golding as the two main characters.
I know this is a far throw from A Hidden Paradise, but wherever you are in the world, that's where I belong.
But I...
Rachel Chu, will you marry me and make me the happiest man in this world?
Yes, 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 I will marry you!
All right, so that sounds pretty standard in terms of romantic comedy. How does this fit the template, and are there ways in which it didn't, Crazy Rich Asians?
I mean, in many ways, it 100% did, which is, I think, why so many people saw its incredible success as a sign that, okay, now romantic comedy is back. You know, it's a very classic, traditional, funny love story. In other ways, it's not quite traditional. I mean, it's a film that has a predominantly Asian cast. That's definitely not something we're used to seeing in romantic comedies, especially not with the kind of box office sales that this film got. But in many ways, it's the same old story.
And one thing that was a twist there, though, there was you write there was some hope that Crazy Rich Asians would do really well in Asia because it featured Asian characters, and it didn't. Is there something about romantic comedy that just has a hard time translating from, I don't know, one language to another, one culture to another?
People have said that. That's definitely something that's been speculated, that perhaps, you know, because romantic comedy, ultimately, it's reflecting a certain norm within a particular society. It tends to. So, you know, that doesn't always translate well. And comedy also doesn't always translate well from culture to culture. But, you know, Crazy Rich Asians, it was interesting when the book was getting optioned for movie rights. There was quite a kind of bidding war over who would get this film. And one of the things that was said at the time was that there was this real hope that it would do quite well in Asia. And I think it was pretty disappointing when it really struggled to kind of get an audience, particularly in China.
Now let's talk about the guy thing. I think there's a stigma sometimes among men that romantic comedies are movies for women and thus not for me if I'm a guy. Is that part of maybe what led to the changes from it being a big box office presence?
I think that's a big part of it. I think that traditionally this is a niche that the film industry has used as kind of what they call, you know, the chick flick programming. And that's not necessarily to say that a diverse range of people don't enjoy these movies. And that's not to say that they can't, you know, hit with a lot of different folks around the world. But in terms of Hollywood, they've certainly been seen as a product for women. And they've been marketed as such. And that sort of kind of creates a kind of norm that says that, well, men maybe shouldn't watch this. And maybe they should run away and watch the Avengers instead or something like that. So, yeah, I think there's definitely some stigma attached to that. And it's something that is a bit of a problem because, you know, again, you see films like 40-Year-Old Virgin or different kind of Judd Apatow projects, which would definitely be romantic comedies, but we're not going to feel comfortable calling them that because there's this perception that that'll scare away certain audiences.
We're talking to Catherine Morrissey, assistant professor in the School of Cinema at San Francisco State University. We're talking about romantic comedies, what some people call a rebirth of the romantic comedy. She doesn't buy that. After the success of Crazy Rich Asians and other romantic comedies on Netflix, you can join in at 800-642-1234. What counts as a romantic comedy to you? What is your favorite past, present, distant past, older classics, maybe? Do you see a romantic comedy element in a movie like The 40-Year-Old Virgin or Knocked Up? Is this something that'll get you to a theater, or is this something that will get you scrolling through, say, Netflix to find a romantic comedy at home? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about the romantic comedy genre, how it's changed since the 1980s, why some think we're seeing a rebirth of the genre. Our guest says it's been there all along. It's just changed in some ways, including how we watch it. Catherine Morrissey is with us from San Francisco State University's School of Cinema. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you love romantic comedies? Do you hate them? Do you love to hate them? Is there a favorite, a current one from back in the 80s and 90s, or maybe from a Hollywood golden age era? What do you think about romantic comedies? Do you want to see more of them in theaters? Do you appreciate that they pop up on a streaming service like Netflix? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We heard from MC on Facebook who said the golden oldies were more romantic, but oh so sexist. Catherine, I don't know which golden oldie era she's talking about exactly, but is there something there, maybe in any era?
I mean, I think it depends on the individual film, but they certainly tend to echo the norms of the time. And if the norms of the time are a bit sexist, that can tend to wind up in the film as well. But, you know, everyone always kind of looks back at the past as if it's always been exactly the same. And, you know, there's been a lot of different waves and cycles to romantic comedy. Some people look back at the screwball romances from the, you know, early 1930s and as a time when there was a lot of really kind of interesting, fast-talking heroines. So it's not necessarily consistently sexist. It tends to vary a bit.
Now, there's that movie. I actually saw this in the theater. It was Rebel Wilson, and it was a romantic comedy kind of takeoff, playing on the variations of the romantic comedy and the, you know, the themes and things like that, but kind of trying to keep a distance from it. Do we have that ironic relationship with the rom-com sometimes?
Yeah, and you know, what's interesting is a lot of the romantic comedies that came out in the 80s and the 90s really made that a part of the story. You know, if you look at something like Sleepless in Seattle, a huge part of the conversation in that movie is about other romantic movies and how the heroine, Meg Ryan, in Sleepless in Seattle, feels about romance. So we're kind of obsessed with talking about this formula and thinking about whether it works or not and how we feel about it. And then ultimately, we still want to see the happy ending at the end, so we loop back around to it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about not the movies themselves, but how we watch them and how we get them. That's with any kind of movie, that's changed a lot in just the last few years. How has that affected the romantic comedy?
Well, that's something that I'm really interested in, because when Crazy Rich Asians came out, it wasn't just that film that made people say that it felt like the romantic comedy was back. At the exact same time, Netflix had launched this campaign that they called their Summer of Love, and they were releasing a bunch of different romantic comedy films. The big one that got, I think, the most attention was To All the Boys I've Loved Before. And that was, by Netflix's standards, an incredibly well-received film as well. And you see Netflix investing a ton of money in building up that category in their database. So it seems like on streaming services like Netflix, this is seen as a genre that they really want to invest in and that people, they perceive their subscribers are very interested in.
Let's go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Cindy on the line in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. Well, I would just like to say that with all the violence that's in the movies nowadays, a romantic comedy is a breath of fresh air and a change of pace from all the violence.
Interesting, Cindy. Thanks a lot. Do you see that as part of the appeal, Catherine?
Yeah, I think, you know, people love to, it's, you know, we like to indulge in serious stories and fun stories. You know, we need all of the above to get through our lives in this world today.
Thanks again, Cindy, for that call. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on romantic comedies, love of or dislike of same. Catherine Morrissey stays with us, assistant professor in the School of Cinema at San Francisco State University. So you mentioned, Catherine, that Summer of Love at Netflix. Did that stick around? Did they keep up that pace of romantic comedy release, or did it fizzle again since then?
It seems to have stuck around, and they seem to be consistently bringing in more and more romantic comedies into the Netflix database. And we also see recently Hulu launched their own version of Four Weddings and a Funeral. So there's definitely some kind of interest in it from the streaming services. And part of what's been interesting on Netflix is they seem to really strategically be investing in a lot of different versions of romantic comedy. They have different kinds of queer romance. They have international romances in the mix. And then they have stories like To All the Boys I Loved Before, which is going to have a sequel coming out in basically the next week or two. And then is in theory, going to have a third iteration in the trilogy coming out as well.
And we, as you mentioned, we're seeing more diverse looks in romantic comedies. Is that changing the structure, the plot of the movie, or is it just kind of the same formula with a different demographic?
I'd say a little of both. It tends to follow a very similar plot line, but one of the things I've been noticing is that the endings of these stories are sometimes getting a little more ambivalent. Like, there's a really interesting film on Netflix. And of course, I'm blanking on the name as I talk to you. It's The Adventures of Jessica Jones or Jessica James. I apologize for not remembering. But that film is this wonderful story about a young woman trying to figure out her life and her career and her love life. And then I don't want to spoil the ending, but when you get to the ending, it's not necessarily what you would consider a traditional romantic ending. So there seem to be ways that the formula might be getting poked at a little bit, even if it's not totally being destabilized.
We've got a listener email. Our listener says, I think streaming services are the new home for romantic comedies. I love being at home in front of the fire and watching a rom-com. I don't see the genre as something I would pay to see in a movie theater. My latest favorite is Always Be My Maybe on Netflix. Romantic comedies starring stand-up comedians are the new rom-com. Okay, we got a lot to work with there. Always Be My Maybe, first of all.
I thought Always Be My Maybe was really, really fun. And part of what was so interesting about it is, again, you've got a film with predominantly Asian cast, and they're, you know, the people involved in that project are so aware of the way that Asian Americans have been traditionally represented in the media, and they're taking this very traditional love story, they're having fun with the formula, and really purposefully trying to poke at people's stereotypes and assumptions about Asian Americans as well. That was a really enjoyable film. I also think what that person just said really echoes back to what the earlier caller said, right? If these films for many people are comfort viewing, what's more comfortable than doing it at home?
And well, the other thing there is, and I think a lot of people have had this thought process that I have, okay, that movie, it's got a lot of special effects. It's a big visual thing. That's the one I need to see at a theater. That's not usually going to be true of the romantic comedy. So I'm just as well off seeing it home on the TV.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And, you know, it kind of fits with, you know, where Hollywood seems to be spending its money right now. They're very interested in these big budget, incredibly expensive global franchises because they think that's the reason why people will come to the movie theaters. And if people are less inclined to go see the romantic comedy at the movie theaters, well, then it probably makes sense that someone like Netflix is going to be the place where those films seem to be popping up more.
Oh, I got an assist from a producer here. The Incredible Jessica James was the movie title.
It
wasn't on the tip of my tongue either. Yeah. So I'm seeing sometimes now with movies these hybrid releases where it's, you know, it's not theater and then months later it comes to, you know, a streaming service. They do this joint release. Is that the wave of the present, I guess, not even future?
You know, I think that's an excellent question. I wonder, it could be. I wonder if they're experimenting with that to see if they get enough ticket sales in the movie theater to justify a release in movie theaters. I think we'll have to wait and see where this goes because from my end of things, it looks like a lot of this is the industry testing to see where these products might still be viable.
Now, you've done a lot of work on romantic comedies. You've got this three-part series. You're writing on it. Are they still fun? Do you still enjoy them after digging into them kind of deeply?
I do. I totally do. Although I always confess that part of the reason why I got fascinated with romance and romantic comedies in general is because of my constant ambivalent response to them. Some of them I love. Some of them I'm frustrated by. I would fight about them with my mother and my grandmother. All of us would have different opinions. And that's part of why I got so interested in them, because I think they provoke these responses from us where we both love and hate them and are distressed by them but want to see more of them. And I think that's a huge part of the fun.
What can be frustrating about a rom-com in particular for you?
Oh, you know, when I was growing up, you know, I was a young girl. I had, you know, strong feminist, was figuring out that I was queer. And I definitely had this sense that, like, you know, I really wish the stories were a little more diverse. I wanted to see different kinds of love stories. I didn't always want to see everyone ending and feeling like they were going to get married the next day. And I think that's the part that always frustrated me. I just wanted a bigger mix of stories and representing different kind of experiences around the world. And, you know, that's the place I think they're still kind of struggling. But, you know, hopefully we're seeing some change and some diversity.
In our last minute or so, what are you watching for the future of the rom-com?
Well, I am really excited for the second part in the To All the Boys I Loved Before saga. I have to admit, I've made plans to watch that on Netflix next week. I'm also very curious to see what happens and if we get a sequel for Crazy Rich Asians.
Catherine, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks so much.
That was Catherine Morrissey, assistant professor in the School of Cinema at San Francisco State University. She is with us today to talk about her three-part series at Flow Journal, looking at the evolution of romantic comedies, how they've changed over time, how they've stayed the same over time as well. Still time for you to share your thoughts or maybe just your rom-com recommendations. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Or head over and share your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Maybe you can give people a playlist for the next couple weeks of romantic comedies. Coming up, we'll break down President Trump's newly expanded travel ban. 6 countries added to the list. Big story overshadowed in some ways by all the impeachment news over the last couple of weeks. We'll find out more. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, Governor Tony Evers brings us the latest on his call for a special session of the legislature and his plan to use a projected state budget surplus for education. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, as President Trump's impeachment trial was taking place, the administration announced an expansion of his controversial travel ban. It already included Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, Yemen, Venezuela, and North Korea. The expansion was unveiled last Friday and covers 6 more countries, Nigeria, Myanmar, Eritrea, Kyrgyzstan, Sudan, and Tanzania. It's set to take effect on February 22nd. Acting Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf said, for the most part, those new countries want to be helpful but have failed to meet U.S. security and information sharing standards. Democrats and immigration advocates are accusing the administration of discriminating against Muslims. Hiroshi Motomura is the Susan Westerberg Prager Distinguished Professor of Law at UCLA and the author of Immigration Outside the Law. His areas of expertise include immigration and citizenship. Hiroshi, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, before we get into exactly what the travel ban means for people from these 6 countries, can you talk about what we know about why these 6 particular countries are on the list?
Well, Rob, I think you summarized it nicely a few sentences ago. The stated reasons for this expanded ban have to do with the failure or alleged failure of these countries to meet certain security standards with regards to issuance of travel documents. For example, some of the countries don't issue electronic passports and that kind of thing. And so the stated reason is to essentially make it harder for people to come from these countries try to do something about the apparent security risk. That's at least what the government's stated reasons are.
So you're emphasizing stated reasons. Do you see other possible motivations?
Well, I mean, I think that there's always a balancing here in these kinds of national security sorts of interests. I mean, I think that the cost, or I should say the impact of this, is really quite severe on the countries that you mentioned. This has been true for the countries that were covered by the original ban and also by the new ban. For example, Nigeria has a very substantial population, and all immigrants from Nigeria are essentially restricted in entry here. And so, any national security considerations like this are a question of balancing the apparent risk balancing that against the harm or the burdens put on people. And I think this is that to restrict these. I've seen nothing to suggest that the harms that the government cites would justify the degree of restriction on a country basis. That's just my thoughts on that. But I mean, I do think that there's a serious difference of opinion here about exactly how to strike the balance between the possibility of national security risks and the severe consequences on U.S. citizens, businesses, colleges, and universities.
Now, the administration says it's not a blanket ban for these six countries. A DHS official was quoted as saying, because we have higher confidence that these six countries will be able to make improvements in their system in a reasonable period of time, we did not feel it would be proportionate to impose restrictions on all immigrant and non-immigration visas. So it doesn't apply to everybody. Who could, from these countries, still enter the U.S.?
Well, this is interesting because for Kyrgyzstan, Myanmar, Nigeria, and Eritrea, the people restricted are immigrants. In other words, people who may be joining family members or coming to a job in the United States. That's who's restricted, people who are going to stay here indefinitely with green cards. What's not restricted, interestingly, are people who are coming on any kind of a non-indefinite basis, in other words, students, business people, tourists, and things of that nature. It's curious because you would think that if you were concerned about the national security implications, you would have restricted people who would come in under all circumstances.
Would the argument be there's some kind of different vetting in the home countries like Nigeria of that temporary, that student, say, versus the potential immigrant?
Maybe. But I mean, the vetting for immigrants is already quite strong. I mean, I'll add that to my earlier answer to your question about national security. One of the things that that I think gets lost in this is that before these bans, there's an earlier one in 2000. It's been in effect for several years now, and then there's this new one. It's not as if prior administrations or the federal government had not been doing a lot of security vetting already. It was already extremely difficult. Well, put it this way, there's a lot of vetting to check security in these sorts of situations. And so, it's not as if we're all of a sudden worried about security and we weren't worried about it before. I think the government has always been worried about this, certainly true under Obama.
Talking to Hiroshi Motomura from UCLA about the new expansion to the travel ban list here in the United States, six new countries added. Hiroshi, what do we know about the impact of the existing travel ban once it got through the court system? What has that looked like since it's been actually in effect?
Well, I mean, there is a waiver process. In other words, a process where people who are trying to come to the United States to, as I said, in most cases, to join family members, even spouses, and to some extent join to work. There's a process by which they can apply for exceptions, or to put it in legal terms, for a waiver. But all reports I've seen suggest a couple of things. One is that this process is cumbersome. In other words, it takes a long time. It's expensive to get the help to be able to put those put your argument together that you should be an exception. And the numbers of immigrants coming to the United States from country, Iran is probably the most numerically affected. In other words, I think about 50% of the first version of the ban affected Iranians. The numbers are really down. And so I think it's having a severe impact on communities. And I think that this ban will have a similar effect, notwithstanding the exceptions. Nigeria is an extremely populous country with a large number of U.S. citizens of Nigerian ancestry in the United States, and they're going to really feel the impact in terms of having family members sponsored or having people come to take jobs on legal employment visas.
The previous travel ban went through a few different incarnations, lots of court challenges. Do you expect a lot to happen in the courts with this newly expanded list, or is this something that since the Supreme Court sorted out the old one, we have precedent, so there might not be that kind of court battle?
Well, I mean, what the Supreme Court did is it let the first ban go into effect, right? But there's still litigation. There's still a court case going on. There's actually several of them having to do with exactly how the ban is being implemented. And the concern there is that the way it's being implemented is really discriminatory on the basis of, for example, of religion. And so nothing the Supreme Court said a couple years ago that let the first ban go into effect changes the fact that there's still ongoing litigation about that. And I suspect that the application of the second ban will draw a similar response. That said, the Supreme Court made it clear that it regards the president's power to do national security-based proclamations like this, that the court regarded the president's power as broad. So it's definitely going to be difficult to challenge these. But at the same time, I want to emphasize that these court cases haven't fully played out yet, because I think the evidence that the waiver process is extremely restrictive may have a bearing on how this all ends up in the end. And, you know, it's clear that a lot of this is going to turn on the results of the 2020 election. And so that may be more immediate or sooner, certainly, than any court challenge would play out anyway.
We're talking about President Trump's newly expanded travel ban with Hiroshi Motomura. He's a law professor at UCLA, author of Immigration Outside the Law. You can join us at 800-642-1234. Are you following this story? Does it affect you or someone you know who might want to come from one of these countries to the United States? Do you think it's a necessary security measure? Do you worry that it is discriminatory? Three Muslim majority countries, two with substantial Muslim minorities, I believe, added to the list. What questions do you have about how all this works, how the travel ban is applied, how these waivers and exemptions might work? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our conversation about President Trump's expanded travel ban. It was announced last Friday. It includes Nigeria, Eritrea, Kyrgyzstan, Myanmar, Sudan, and Tanzania. Hiroshi Motomura is our guest, law professor at UCLA and author of the book Immigration Outside the Law. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you support the wider ban or not? Have you been following this story? Overall, what do you think of U.S. policy under President Trump on immigration, legal and illegal? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Hiroshi, this is one of many changes to immigration policy under the Trump administration. How do you see it fitting in overall to what we've seen in the last few years?
Well, certainly the Trump administration has done a lot on the immigration front. Some of what it has done has been to address illegal or undocumented immigration, depending on the term you prefer to use. And then what's interesting about the this so-called travel ban is that it's really of a different, it's really focusing more on lawful immigration. In other words, we're talking about people who've applied, stood in line, maybe paid the fees. And so I think of this ban as being related in various ways to an overall effort that I see from the Trump administration to limit legal immigration to the United States. So this is, the ban is one. There's more of a test of financial means that's going to affect. And there are some other things that are going on that are a little bit less dramatic, but I think very impactful. And one of them is the fees, proposals to increase the fees substantially, substantial delays in processing of everything from visas to naturalization. And I think it's significant that the phrase nation of immigrants is no longer part of the mission statement of the agency that processes most of these forms inside the United States. And so I think that there's a skepticism of legal immigration to the United States that we see from this administration that we really haven't seen for the last half century or so, certainly not in sort of the more modern decades. And so I think that this is, it doesn't surprise me that there's a ban here, but although this has a different character because it's focused on certain countries, it's also, a lot of people think that, I mean, I think one of the things that it has not managed to disassociate itself from is the fact that this was a follow through on a campaign promise to have a Muslim ban.
Right. And let's talk about the countries selected on the original list, with the exceptions of Venezuela and North Korea. I think Muslim majority countries, most of the ones on the list, Muslim majority or substantial Muslim minorities. That isn't, of course, that isn't how they're being billed in the new announcement of the travel ban, though, is it?
That's right. That's right. I mean, this is what's interesting throughout this whole sequence is that the original campaign promise morphed into an executive order that actually had some tinges of racial, religious singling out. And then that gradually got taken over by some more elaborate national security justifications. And the national security justifications are what are stated, in this particular expansion of the travel ban.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Milwaukee. Mike, hello.
Hi. As far as anything Trump does, as far as immigration, travel bans, or anything like that, it really doesn't have anything to do with really being concerned about security or realistic immigration reform or anything like that. Everything he basically does is just part of his show. It's just part of things that are talking points for his crowd. Things that his crowd likes to hear and gets them all riled up at the rallies. And realistically, everything he does as far as immigration is just part of his big show that he's putting on. So it's just a sad thing that all these people have to suffer just for getting caught up in part of his campaign, I guess.
Mike, thanks for the call. Mike saying, Hiroshi, this is more about politics than about policy. What do you think?
Well, I think it's about politics and his version of policy. In other words, I do think that, President Trump believes that there is too much legal immigration, too much immigration in general to the United States. But I do agree with the caller that this is also part of what he feels that his base wants. But the other thing that I think the caller says, which I think bears emphasis, is that I think that the story that the Trump campaign is telling is one of we. With quote marks around the word, we are in the United States, and there are all these people on the outside trying to get in, and so we need to err on the side of absolute safety. I mean, that's really but as the caller points out, there are many, many U.S. citizens who are married to people in these countries. There are many employers who want to hire people from these countries. There are many colleges and universities that thrive, not just financially, but also in terms of the enrichment environment for education from these countries. And so this is not a question of we on the inside trying to keep people from the outside out. It's also the fact that there are many U.S. citizens who have the deepest and most intimate relations with the people trying to really join their spouses in this country.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Hiroshi, in our last 30 seconds or so, what is the next story you're watching for in immigration policy?
Well, I think that the Supreme Court let go into effect the so-called public charge rule. That is makes it harder to get into the United States based on the financial means. So I'm watching that story. And more fundamentally, I think what's striking about what this administration has done is it has done more than any other administration to change the law without ever going to get Congress to do something. And so this is an administration that's been incredibly active and really pushing the boundaries of what presidents and administrations can do without Congress being involved. That's the objection to the financial means test. It's that it's not really required by Congress. And so I'm watching at a larger level is, what is the president's power to change the immigration system without Congress giving its approval?
Hiroshi, thanks again for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Hiroshi Motomura is a professor of law at UCLA and author of the book Immigration Outside the Law. His areas of expertise include immigration and citizenship. He joined us today for a look at President Trump's now expanded travel ban that's going to kick into effect a little later this month. It would now include Nigeria, Eritrea, Kyrgyzstan, Myanmar, Sudan, and Tanzania. Many people looking to come to the United States, especially for purposes of immigration. The currently existing ban includes countries like Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, Yemen, North Korea, and Venezuela. The new restrictions, the ones that affect those new countries on the list, would take effect on February 22nd.
Oh,
A Canadian energy firm is exploring alternate routes for an oil pipeline that runs through northern Wisconsin. Last summer, the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa filed a lawsuit against Enbridge aimed at shutting down and removing the pipeline from the tribe's reservation. Enbridge is exploring two possible routes, and some communities are divided over the path they might take. Danielle Kading has more.
I'll just walk you over here.
Snow is lightly falling on a January afternoon while Jan Penn trudges through deep snow by Billy Creek on her land in Ashland County. She's found young fish in the Class 1 trout stream that empties into the Marengo River, which drains into the Bad River watershed. The watershed is home to sturgeon and trout and some of the most high-quality wetlands in the Great Lakes. It's part of the reason she and her husband rejected Enbridge's request to survey their land for a roughly 40-mile reroute of Line 5 running south of the Bad River Reservation through Ashland and Iron Counties.
This is just a very unique place with some of the cleanest water in the world.
Penn wants to preserve that and her land, but others see the value their property may bring to struggling communities.
I'm the one who went to Enbridge and said, I need money, I'll help you.
That's Mellon Mayor Joe Barabee heading into an Ashland County board meeting. He was eager to work with Enbridge. The city reached a deal to sell land north of Mellon for $1 million as part of rerouting Line 5. If the pipeline is built, Mellon would receive another $3 million. But because the land in question was designated for public use, the sale depended on approval of the county board. Barabee was there to make the case for the sale. He said the deal is the city's only chance to get out of debt from costly wastewater upgrades. He says they're also facing an expensive road project that will include improving water and sewer lines below.
Half of Mellon is fixed income. Those people won't even afford water when we're done with them.
Mellon's deal also benefits Ashland County, which would get $500,000 from the sale. Without the board's approval, Enbridge said the company would be forced to pursue another route south of Mellon, and the city and county would lose out on the money. Mellon resident Peter Jokinen has a family of six and says his water bills have gone up from $75 to almost $400.
It's ridiculous. This saves us.
Ashland resident Ted Griggs pointed to the company's environmental track record.
It didn't work perfectly in Kalamazoo.
Enbridge spent $1.2 billion cleaning up Michigan's Kalamazoo River after one of its pipelines burst there in 2010. Bad River officials urged the county to hold off on the vote and think of what the reroute would mean for the watershed. Tribal chairman Mike Wiggins told the board everyone is being played by Enbridge.
The other scam that's in play here is that we actually have a choice. It's either the southern route or the northern route. No, they're in the watershed. And they've been asked to leave.
But the board allowed the sale to move ahead. Enbridge spokeswoman Jennifer Smith says that's a key factor in which route they'll choose.
Very soon we do plan to announce a route that we're going to be taking and we'll start that permitting application.
That process begins with the Public Service Commission. But state regulators won't have a say on the company's proposed route. Matt Sweeney is a PSC spokesman.
The commission only has jurisdiction in cases where somebody wants to use eminent domain to acquire land to build that pipeline. So in those cases, the PSC has to find that the acquisition is in the public interest.
Sweeney says that's unlike the commission's review of natural gas pipelines. It's also unlike surrounding states. A 2015 report by a Michigan task force found Michigan, Minnesota, and Illinois all have the authority to determine where pipelines can or can't go in their states. For Jan Penn, there's no route that would protect water from a potential spill.
We don't know where this is going to go, but we're not going to give in easy.
Enbridge has offered Bad River a $24 million settlement to keep the line in place, but the tribe has made no indication it intends to drop its fight to shut down the pipeline across its reservation. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a new study says that most Americans don't have money available for an emergency expense of $1,000. A financial planner joins the show with some advice on how to set aside rainy day money. We'll get the latest on the Democratic primary from the Iowa whatever's happening to next week's voting in New Hampshire. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We continue our series on simple cooking. This time, we'll cut down on the cleanup with some one-pot recipes. That and look at some of the top news stories going on around Wisconsin. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.